Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence brief on the war for the free world. Few people understand this war and its historic implications as well as the trajectories of history than our guest for this very special hour. He is Victor Davis Hanson, truly one of the great thinkers, scholars, practitioners, writers, and commentators on matters great and small of our time. He is the author of myriad terrific books, including most recently The Savior Generals, How Five Great Commanders Saved Wars That Were Lost, from Ancient Greece to Iraq. Victor Davis Hanson, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Thank you for giving us so much of your time, and we're always delighted to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
I hardly know where to begin. There's so much to talk with you about. Let's go through them in no particular order, except that one that is very much at the forefront of, I think, our national consciousness at the moment, or at least should be, is Iran. The Islamic Republic of Iran, the nation that the president is engaged with, trying to fashion some sort of nuclear deal. We're told that they're no longer a terrorism threat by the Director of National Intelligence. What did you make of that finding, and more broadly, what they're up to at the moment?
Well, I don't know what his evidence was. Until 9/11, they'd been the greatest harvester of American lives of all radical Islamic terrorist groups. It was Iranian-sponsored terrorists that killed more Americans. And then, of course, except for the ex-Baathists and Al-Qaeda, they killed more Americans than any other group while we were fighting Iraq. They caused us harm in Afghanistan. So I think what we're seeing is that among the administration, there's a party line now that bringing Iran into the fold of U.S. normalization, and maybe even making it, considering not just a neutral instead of an enemy, but maybe even an ally, that sort of trumps all other considerations. Everybody has to get on board with that theme.
And an ally specifically in contesting the Islamic State's increasing hold on parts of Iraq.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think we're willing to give up certain ideas that we can defeat ISIS without Iran, or that Syria, somebody, Bashar Assad is a bad guy in Syria. We've dropped these ideas like that, or that Iran shouldn't have a bomb, or that Iran threatens Israel. We just don't consider those. It's sort of like the Soviet Union in the United States in December of 1941, late December, early 42, it was just sort of verboten for American to say that Stalin had liquidated his officer class, or there had been 20 million killed in the purges and the great starvations and the collectivizations. You just didn't do that because it was considered a valuable ally.
Yeah, Uncle Joe and all of that. Victor, one of the things that's a corollary to this is now they are seemingly airbrushing out Hezbollah as a threat as well. And when you combine both the predations of Iran over the years and those of its proxy, Hezbollah, I mean, you really are essentially rewriting history in a fashion, are you not?
Yes, I think so, because they were probably responsible for the Beirut bombings, and they're probably Israel's arch enemy. And a lot of it has to do with Israel. If you start to reconfigure Israel as a neutral in the area and not an ally, then the existential enemies of Israel are not necessarily your existential enemies either.
Even if they declare themselves to be such. I want to come back to Israel for a longer drill down in a moment, but just staying with Iran, Victor, we've had quite the kerfuffle lately with the administration denouncing and serially describing as anti-constitutional and unhinged these 47 members of the United States Senate who warned the Iranian regime against a deal that was not submitted to Congress. As a serious student of our republic, its constitution, our processes, what did you make of this thrash, and where do you think we are left in its aftermath?
I think you can only draw two conclusions. One is that the Obama administration either doesn't know much about American history or doesn't feel that it should apply to them, because it's early, you know, best examples during the Versailles Treaty, the Republican Senate just decided that they weren't going to give up American autonomy and independence to an international body, League of Nations. They just basically told Wilson to forget it, and they sabotaged it, and Wilson left Versailles as the most unpopular guy there. And we saw it during the Reagan administration with Ted Kennedy. Examples have been widely cited in the news. Kerry himself was negotiating and freelancing, as was Nancy Pelosi at various times. So I think he knows that that's not true. And then why is he so angry about it? That's the second point. And I think that is that Iran now is a keystone. It really is the keystone of what's foreign policy in shambles. He feels that every other thing didn't work. Libya didn't work. The Arab Spring reach out to the Muslim Brotherhood didn't work. Reset didn't work. The new South American coziness with Hugo Chavez type governments didn't work. And I think he's left with Iran. And he can tolerate no criticism of Iran or that Iranian policy. And then the other issue about interference is abject hypocrisy, because while he was warning us, warning the Senate not to be involved in administration policy, he was sending David Cameron not long ago to lobby U.S. senators to make sure they didn't up the sanctions on Iran. He's been interfering himself in the elections probably in Israel. So I don't think he really believes that he's been consistent or that there's any aberration in American foreign policy. It just gets back to what we talked about, that Iran for some reason has a magical hold over Barack Obama. I think he's also very sympathetic to revolution, what he deems are revolutionary societies, not China anymore, Putin anymore, but societies like Turkey, Cuba, Venezuela, and Iran that he feels are authentic, they're legitimate, they're grassroots, the people are speaking, and then he's willing to overlook their anti-Americanism, or he understands it, or he contextualizes it.
Or may even feel a certain sympathy for it, worst of all.
I think when a million Iranians went out in the streets in spring of 2009, he felt that they were inauthentic, they were neoconservative, or they were too westernized, and so that he really is attracted to these magnetic so-called third world leaders that represent a society that's always in sort of revolutionary fervor.
Yeah. You know, I was struck in trying to figure out the inconsistency, and you may be absolutely right, Victor Davis Hanson, that he just doesn't care about being inconsistent. But there was one common denominator between his posture vis-a-vis the Green Revolution, as it was called, in Iran, and the indifference to any kind of evidence of solidarity with those folks who were trying to overthrow a repressive regime on the one hand, and on the other, his all-in posture with respect to the Muslim Brotherhood trying to do the same to the authoritarian, to be sure, but at least pro-Western Mubarak regime in Egypt. And that common denominator was, in both cases, he was doing what the Islamists wanted him to do, even though the practical upshot of it was 180 degrees out of sync. This suggests that there is a certain solidarity, not just sympathy, with such folks. And certainly we've seen a lot of evidence that American policy is being skewed. As you say, the Muslim Brotherhood outreach being just one example of this. Do you anticipate that in the remainder of this presidency we're going to see an even more intensified ratcheting up of this affinity for and solidarity with such revolutionaries?
Yes, I do. I think there's a lot of factors that explain it. You've mentioned one, but he does seem to think that they're more authentic. He thinks that Israel, for example, is a Western interloper, that its existence was somehow unnatural, or that people in the Gulf states or people in Egypt have been, or the Shah in the past, were artificial creations of Western cabals or conspiracies, and that the Islamists, whether you like them or not, represent an authentic groundswell of popular opinion, even though they usually don't. But he's very sympathetic. And then there's something that I don't know how to explain it, because it's a feeling that one gets that he likes to tweak people. In other words, in the last 2 years of his presidency, when he says things that don't make much sense. I have a pen and I have a phone and I'm going to do this. And then he contradicts himself on Obamacare or on immigration, or he goes down to Ferguson and says things that don't make sense. And he knows that this irritates people. And he doesn't have to worry about losses in the Democratic Party because basically, in the modern sense, it's been ruined or at least reduced to a level of the 1920s in the House Senate. But he enjoys getting people angry, and I think one of the things that he kind of enjoys is tweaking people who support Israel or support traditional bipartisan Middle East policy.
Hold that thought, Victor Davis Hanson, because we're going to come right back on that question of what is he trying to do in terms of remaking the Middle East with respect both to our allies and our enemies. That and more with Victor Davis Hanson, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country. The one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
Ready to roll?
Go for it.
Hi, I'm Jessie Jane Duff. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant, and I served 20 years on active duty serving this great country. I'm with Concerned Veterans for America now. After I got off active duty, I realized I still wanted to be involved and help change the direction our country is going. Concerned Veterans for America offered me that great opportunity. If you want to get involved and you're thinking of getting involved, please visit our website because we have many activities throughout the nation. We have wonderful representatives in each state who are putting forward different ways you can become engaged. So go to the website at concernedveteransforamerica.org, and you do not have to be a veteran. But if you support the freedoms that we all fought so hard for to defend this great nation, then consider participating in the many activities we are participating in and helping to change the direction our country is going.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. Victor Davis Hanson is our guest, the author most recently of The Savior Generals, How Five Great Commanders Saved Wars That Were Lost from Ancient Greece to Iraq. He is the Martin and Ely Anderson Senior Fellow in Residence in Classics and Military History at the Hoover Institution. And you were talking, Victor, about the degree to which we are witnessing a man who seems to delight in causing sort of provocations with folks, notably Americans, with whom he does not agree, but others as well. I wonder whether your view of this is that sort of in combination with this kind of revolutionary zeal and certainly the DNA, the political DNA that he brings to the job, is you know, beyond just sort of poking people in the eye. It is designed to, well, create, ferment, turmoil, even revolutionary conditions.
I think that was just a dessert that he sees, but the main course is he feels that the post-war order is sort of analogous to the 1% hegemony at home. In other words, the post-war order was not fair. It privileged the West, Europe, the United States, and the former British Commonwealth in particular. And it wasn't the rules were so-called rigged. And when he looks at this, and he understands now in the last 2 years especially, he's becoming much more bold, that his foreign policy in traditional terms is a failure, so is his domestic agenda, so he's going to become sort of an avatar of radical change. And I think he feels that, you know, there were particular governments that exercised undue influence. So the natural order of things in the Middle East is probably in a Persian-Iranian hegemony. The natural order of things, you can't do much with Putin. The former Soviet republics are his area. Same thing with the South China Sea and China. And I think he feels maybe even the Caribbean a little bit with Cuba. And that these are legitimate powers that could exercise influence and authority in a way that would make sense once we back out and get our nose out where it doesn't belong.
Yeah. At our expense, or at least the expense of our national interests.
Well, we feel that.
Yeah, it's rectifying errors of the past for which we should be apologetic. And Victor, we've been talking a little bit about sort of this urge for reordering things to the extent that this is, in fact, emboldening or certainly empowering nations profoundly hostile to us. You've mentioned Iran, you've mentioned Russia, you've mentioned China, you've mentioned Cuba. What is it doing to those relatively few nations still who have historically seen themselves as allies? Are you seeing them alienated? Are you seeing them deciding to go their own way?
Yeah, I think it has, of course, a different reaction depending on the region in question. But in case, say, of the Pacific, I think Japan and Taiwan, South Korea, to a lesser extent, maybe even the Philippines or Australia, they're talking among each other, and they're thinking, we are no longer in the American nuclear umbrella, or we're not really going to be recipients of American aid and extremists, so we have to decide whether to cut a deal with the Chinese or we have to develop our own deterrent. And I think that's pretty clear. That's happening as we speak. That's one reaction to it. In the Middle East, same thing. Egypt is talking to the Saudi Arabia is talking to the South Koreans about a nuclear deterrent. You may find some of the Gulf states or Sunni states buy a nuclear weapon from Pakistan. And the sense is that the United States either can or won't protect them, so they'll have to take their security into their own hands to a far greater degree. I think a lot of people are confused still because they feel that when there was two midterm elections and there was hope for Obama really having a legislative, you know, majority, and now they see that he's sort of, in the next 2 years, he's just going to freelance, and that the Senate and the House are going to try to butt heads trying to stop him. But there's something going on there, and they feel that bad actors, whether it's Putin or the Chinese or the Iranians or whomever, or ISIS, whoever they are going to take advantage of this last 2 years because they feel that American power won't be used against them, and our allies are kind of exasperated, and they've given up now trying to convince us, and they're trying to find their own salvation in any way they can.
Yeah. Let me hit a couple of things that you've just raised because they're so important and they're so underappreciated, it seems, in certain quarters at least. The shrinking, or perhaps the folding, of America's nuclear umbrella is, of course, only partly, Victor Davis Hanson, a function of, you know, perceptions of our leadership and robustness and so on. Partly it's a function, isn't it, of the actual declining condition of our nuclear
deterrent. Oh, it absolutely is, especially at a time when other countries, especially Russia, but also China or even France, are taking measures to make sure that their nuclear deterrent is updated. And I think Obama has this sort of 1950s idea that a nuclear weapon in theory could cause so much damage that it would be redundant, when he doesn't understand that, unlike the former Soviet Union or China, we have so many clients that depend on our arsenal who could become nuclear were it not to exist. So in Obama's mind, he would find absurd the fact that South Korea thinks those 100 nukes are deployable and they protect us, and then Japan thinks those are another 100 that protect us. The Philippines, New Zealand, Australia, Europe, all of our people in the Middle East, they think, you know what, the United States needs an inordinate amount of battle-ready nuclear weapons in a way that no other country in the world should have, because they protect so many countries who probably have the expertise and the capital to become nuclear but choose not to, only because of the U.S. And so if you were to tell Obama that actually he is almost ensuring nuclear proliferation, I don't think it would register.
Well, or alternatively, that this is part of the great reordering, that it's actually going to be okay, because that will raise these countries up and diminishing us at the same time.
I think he doesn't quite, because he doesn't know much about history, I don't think he realizes that he's going to ensure that countries he doesn't like Saudi Arabia or Egypt, are going to become nuclear, or Japan's going to become nuclear, or South Korea is going to become nuclear. If he continues with this, it's not just the countries he likes, but our traditional allies may become nuclear as well.
Yeah. Speaking of Saudi Arabia and you know, going back in a way to the Iran thing, you're right. I think there's very little doubt at this point that he is intent on facilitating a new hegemon in the Middle East, namely Iran. But it wasn't so long ago that he was kissing the Saudi king's ring, or hand at least. Where did things change with respect to the Sunnis, with whom he was seemingly very enamored, not just the Saudis, but well, as you said earlier, the Muslim Brotherhood as well?
Well, I think part of it is that two things. One is, once he got us out of Iraq, we were ostensibly not fighting we're not fighting in that combat situation, so it was less difficult to show his cards, so to speak. And then the rise of ISIS, it was so abhorrent that it, the enemy of my enemies, my friend, was now a credible, for a lot of people, it was a credible policy. So ISIS is so pre-modern and barbaric that helping Iran no longer seems to be, you know, helping a barbaric Hezbollah in Obama's way of thinking. So, and then there's not American troops on the ground as well, that people could say, well, this particular policy threatens us because Iranians are killing more Americans in Iraq than any other group. So it was part the fact that we're an isolationist country and we're withdrawing, and partly is because the worldwide abhorrence at ISIS allows him a lot of leeway with vis-a-vis Iran.
Yeah. I want to come back to this issue of the barbarism and the pre-modern character of the Islamic State with you, Victor, because it seems to me as though what we are choosing to ignore, and you've laid out a pretty damning series of examples of what we're ignoring, at least the president is ignoring at the moment, is the inherent character, really, of what jihad is all about, what the doctrine that its adherents call Sharia is all about. The Islamic State is simply carrying that forward, it seems, to its logical conclusion. We'll be right back with more with Victor Davis Hanson on that and many other subjects straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives.
Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. One of the most egregious examples of the politicization of U.S. intelligence came to light yesterday. The Worldwide Threat Assessment, issued by the Director of National Intelligence on behalf of the U.S. intelligence community, no longer reflects either Iran or Hezbollah as terrorist threats. Now, that may jive with President Obama's desire to remove all impediments to a nuclear deal with the Iranians, but it certainly doesn't bear any relation to the facts. Ever since 1979, the mullahs of Iran and their proxies, Hezbollah, have engaged in relentless, murderous jihadist attacks against us, our allies, and interests. Team Obama's serial lies about its incipient capitulation regarding Iran's nuclear ambitions is reprehensible, but its engineering of a threat assessment that does not include two of the greatest terrorist threats we face is downright malfeasant. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
There are many sounds in your daily life. Ones that make you smile. Ones that help you relax. And there are some sounds that can help save lives. Wireless emergency alerts, now on many mobile devices, use a unique sound and vibration to bring you critical information about emergencies in your area. With updates from local sources you know and trust, you can be in the know wherever you are. Learn more at ready.gov/alerts. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. It's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. No matter what happens, if it matters to you and you listen long enough, you'll learn what it means and different ways to think about it. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Victor Davis Hanson is our guest. He is, among other things, a chair of the Military History and Contemporary Conflict Working Group at the Hoover Institution, a professor of classics and military history there, and an emeritus at California State University, Fresno, the author of fabulous columns, two weekly, one for National Review and the other disseminated by Tribune Media Services. He is also the author of The Savior Generals. And I wanted just to drill down on what it is we're up against, Victor, in terms of this jihadism. We've argued that this is really a global jihad, that it brings together in a peculiar way people who clearly have many differences amongst them, particularly over who should run the world, whether they're Shiites or Sunnis or within the Sunni sects of various divisions. But fundamentally, they all have in common this commitment to the triumph of Sharia and imposing it worldwide under some form of sort of theocratic government. That seems not to be registering with the Obama administration and, frankly, a number of our allies as well. Am I missing something or are they?
No, I think he keeps thinking that we have done something in the past and then we can rectify it in the present and then this problem will go away. And I don't think he understands it's an intrinsic, inherent, existential problem Islam in the modern world and even Islam in the medieval world. And what I meant by that is that today a person in a Muslim country can look on the internet, cable TV, and see that things are not very good for most people vis-a-vis South Korea or Brazil, not just the United States or the West. And then they wonder why, and they don't ever say to themselves, it's autocracy, it's socialism, it's statism, it's misogyny, it's tribalism, it's anti-Semitism. Instead, they say, you know, we're not pure enough. It's the Jews did it. The Americans did it. The West did it. Colonialist, imperialist. And Islam is a way of making sense of the insensible. I mean, they think, wow, it's the 21st century. Everybody in the world does well except us. And the answer is because we're not Islamic enough. And therefore, we've got to go back to the 7th century. And we've got to go after the people who did this to us rather than look in the mirror and say, you know what, you're not a victim. These are self-inflicted pathologies. And the reason I'm saying all that is because when we're in the West and we feed into that narrative, or that we say, we use these crazy terms like overseas contingency operation, or our intelligence heads say things like the Muslim Brotherhood's largely secular, or jihad is a legitimate tenet of Islam.
Just about personal struggle, of course.
Yeah. And the same thing with a NASA chief saying, one of my main aims as I talk to the president is to have Muslim outreach and make them feel good about their history. When you do any of this, or when the president says that, you know, just a bunch of folks randomly were killed in a kosher market, he didn't even say kosher, that feeds into the idea that we wouldn't do that unless we feel bad about something we did. Cairo's speech is a good example, the El Arabia's interview that Obama gave. And if, you know, on the contrary, if we were to be bold and confident in our own culture and civilization, said, you know what, you're free to do whatever you want, and here's the road you can take, and it'll lead to democracy or freedom and affluence, or you can go back to the 7th century, but it's your choice. And if you go back to the 7th century, we're going to make sure that you're not going to harm our interest or our people. And I think they would get the message, and we'd have be the same thing as 1945 and 1939. 1939, you couldn't find anybody who wasn't enthralled with Hitler. 1945, you couldn't find one German that claimed he ever was fond of Hitler, because they had seen the wages of what National Socialism had led. So once they understand that jihad leads nowhere but to defeat in Anbar province in the case of Iraq, or vigilance, or a new U.S. policy, or denied entry into a Western country, or deportation if you want to go fight for ISIS, permanent deportation, then I think they would say, wow, this is no longer a romantic activity. It really is painful, and I got to look in the mirror and see what I've done to my country, because these Western countries don't feel guilty anymore.
You know, what you've said very articulately, as always, Victor Davis Hanson, is something that I've been very seized with for a while now, and that is what we have dressed up as multiculturalism or diversity sensitivity or political correctness, as you will, they are, well, hardwired to regard as submission.
Or even worse, affirmation.
Yeah.
When they see us resort to these ridiculous euphemisms, or they see all this so-called outreach, or we're befuddled by the Sarney brothers, or whatever it is, or we think it's workplace violence and Major Hassan kills people in an army base, then they think, wow, see, they kill moderates and reformers among the many in the Middle East. They say, well, look at you guys. If the United States hadn't done something wrong, why are they so worried about offending us? And the reason they are offending them is because they're guilty, and therefore we have the right path to continue to pursue that. And it's really undercuts people who might like us, who were secularized or westernized or liberal in the Middle East. And there's no evidence for anything that Obama has done in history that particular therapeutic approach to foreign policy makes the world safer. We saw it with Woodrow Wilson. We saw it with Jimmy Carter. It just doesn't work. I wish it did, but it doesn't.
One of the things that I promised we'd get back to, and I'm very anxious to get your thoughts on, as we're speaking, we're in the midst of the denouement of the election campaign in Israel. Bibi Netanyahu has been much in the news of late, warning us about this Iranian threat. ostensibly injecting himself in an untoward fashion in our domestic politics. The president seems to be hell-bent on injecting himself in theirs, at taxpayer expense, no less. Talk, if you would, a bit about where you see the relationship between the United States and Israel at this point, and especially should Bibi not win re-election, where we're likely to see it go from here.
Well, I think Obama feels he's unbound now. So he's had four elections, two midterm, two general elections. There's no need to pander or cater, as he would say. And so he's going to revert back to his persona, which was pretty much anti-Israeli. And I say that from the Rashid Khalidi incident or what Reverend Wright said about Jews. Or I could name a number of examples. But he feels that Israel's inauthentic, that it really didn't belong there. The origins were tied up in all sort of big power politics. He doesn't really think that it's legitimate, and he knows he can't get rid of it. So in his way of thinking, he's going to neutralize Israel and just make it one of many countries, and then it's on its own. For Obama, there is no special idea of a Jewish state or the fact that it's the only democratic free market society in the Middle East that works. But none of that matters. In his way of thinking, it's a bunch of Europeans that guilt-tripped the region and then got a bunch of big powers to back them, and they're not as authentic as the Palestinians, or they're not as legitimate as the Jordanians, or whatever it is. And so he's now free to implement that policy, and we're seeing it, what was just jawboning about settlements, and now you really get the impression that we're not an ally. We saw a little bit in the Gaza war where we were delayed some Hellfire missile supplies. When he or his team says that Netanyahu is a coward or chicken shit, whatever he said, or he has an open mic, catches him with Sarkozy, or he tries to undermine an Israeli leader in an election, or he won't even turn on the TV, or Susan Rice says a number of things, you get the impression he just viscerally doesn't like Israel, not just Netanyahu, but the idea of Israel. And one thing I'll say is that I think Israel's in a very dangerous situation now, because if Netanyahu loses and the so-called left coalition comes in, we're polarized in the United States. And what I'm trying to say is that people on the right, or Republican or conservative, are more champions of Israeli security than are on the left now. It didn't used to always be that, but it's clearly true now. And I don't think that they're going to rally to the left in Israel quite to the same degree that they would to Netanyahu. And on the other flip side of the coin, the left is not going to have Obama as an ally. So they're sort of orphaned right now. I think they've sort of said to America, Netanyahu erred. If he loses the election, he erred by pandering to your conservatives. We didn't like that, and now we want to go back to the Democratic mainstream, and they don't realize that there is no Democratic mainstream.
They will not be there for Israel.
And they're not going to be anybody there for Israel.
That's the really worrying thing, because we're creating conditions under which it's seen by these enemies of theirs and ours, as you say, as open season on them all. Victor, we have to pause for just a second. We'll be right back with more on immigration and Hillary's emails. With Victor Davis Hanson, straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We will never fully understand what we've asked of our military service members, of their families, or their children, asking them to deploy, patrol, stay on watch, on point, asking them to put themselves in harm's way, to endure it all. But we do understand that it's our turn, our duty, to bring them all the way home, to keep them secure, to have their backs for the rest of their lives. Wounded Warrior Project long-term support programs do whatever it takes to help our most severely ill or injured veterans live independently, at no cost, for life, so that they might stand at ease. Find out how you can help at findwwp.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm a firefighter.
A teacher.
I'm a farmer.
I'm a barber.
A waitress. A mom.
We're all part of your community. Every day we move in and out of each other's busy lives.
It's easy to take for granted all the little moments that make up our everyday.
Some are good,
others not so much.
But that's life. It's when you experience a moment of uncertainty, something or someone's behavior that doesn't seem quite right.
These are the moments to take a pause.
Because if something doesn't feel right, it's probably not.
It's not about paranoia
or being afraid.
It's about standing up and protecting our communities.
One detail at a time.
Because a lot of little details can become a pattern.
We
trust our instincts.
Just like you should.
Because only you know what's not supposed to be in your everyday.
So protect your everyday.
If you see something suspicious, say something to local authorities.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Gaffney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Victor Davis Hanson is our guest. We're doing one of those extraordinary tours d'horizon that he engages in masterfully with the perspective of a man steeped in the classics as well as history since, an author par excellence, a commentator, and always a wonderful guest. We're delighted to have had him for this hour. Victor, one of the things that I guess you have also really distinguished yourself in discussing in both historical terms and in terms of where it puts us as a polity is what's been developing as a extraordinarily dysfunctional and, I would argue, dangerous immigration program, open borders and the rest of it. Give us a sense of how you see this at this moment in history with the president's executive amnesty and it seemingly now being unchecked by the Congress.
Well, I think it's analogous to his foreign policy. He doesn't believe that artificial constructs like borders that were products of the nation state are legitimate. He, in a more callous and cynical short-term sense, he looks what has happened to California. It's a blue state. It wasn't before. New Mexico is basically a blue state. He thinks that demographically he can change the American Southwest if he is allowed to let in 500,000 illegal aliens per year. He can get a sizable pool of about 10 to 15 million illegal aliens or children, then become anchor babies, and they can change the demographics in a way that's very favorable to the Democratic Party. And more importantly, he feels that they create a constituency for a lot of his social programs, entitlements, and they're a grassroots energizer of the type of Democratic Party that he envisions. And he feels that he can really destroy the Republican manifestation of conservatism. And he may be right. Unfortunately, the Republican establishment keeps thinking that they can outpander Obama by either offering more entitlements or jawboning Latino leaders. And they don't understand there is a solution to the problem, and that is to close the border and to allow the formidable forces of integration, assimilation, and intermarriage work. And we would have something like the Italian-American experience, where today a Giuliani or a Cuomo is no tip-off to what an Italian-American will vote, but will be ideologically on the spectrum.
Yeah. Do you have the feeling that we may have already passed the tipping point on that, that these populations are so large?
Yeah, I am. I feel that it's so lucrative to so many people, not just the employers. And then there's this Latino grievance industry in academia and journalism and government. And then you've got the government of Mexico that likes to have expatriates who are more pro-Mexico the longer they're away from it. And then you have $50 billion in South American remittances, and then you have a safety valve for social tents. So it's a win-win-win situation for Mexico. It's a win-win situation for the Democratic Party. It's win-win for employers. It's win-win for ethnic chauvinists. And there's nobody else really, you know, who can make the argument and say, look, it's killing the lower middle classes who have to compete with jobs. It's kind of an aristocratic labor force of nannies and gardeners for the upper middle class. It's not a good thing. And one of the things we don't talk about is that it's really altered the idea of affirmative action. Latinos were following, as I said, the Italian-American experience, where third generation, they didn't speak Spanish, they were fully integrated. Now, by reason of just nomenclature, if your name is Brandy Lopez, then Brandy Lopez needs affirmative action, because Juan Lopez came from Oaxaca with nothing. He crossed the border, and statistically, he is a Latino just like Brandy, and suddenly, in terms of employment, education, law enforcement issues, health issues, they're not reaching parity vis-a-vis the American mainstream, and then therefore Brandy needs to be given a leg up, and even though she doesn't need it. And so it's very cynical about what the upper middle class and elite Hispanic population has done. They need illegal immigration to create a pool of underprivileged, of who they're the greatest beneficiary.
Yeah, victims. Let's segue from that to the putative beneficiary of all of this, though there are reports now migrating out of the White House that actually they're trying to scupper Hillary Clinton's candidacy for the presidency. Victor, talk a little bit about what your reading is on what Hillary has been up to with this email business and more broadly, the pursuit of the presidency.
Well, I think people are wrong to think that she was trying to hide her private emails. She could have done that on a separate server. This whole thing was cooked up to protect her public emails because she wanted to mix them on one server and then say that I'll be the adjudicator of what's public and private, and I'll just print a few out. It was designed from the get-go to not be accountable of what she was saying. Why would that be? There was things she was doing, I think, in fundraising for the Clinton Foundation, emails exchanged with Benghazi, probably with Reset, things that would be embarrassing, and she had been in so many embarrassments that she was, I guess this time, prophylactic. She thought, I'm going to preempt this problem and solve it this way.
My guess is one other facet of this, for what it's worth, that one of the people that she wanted to be able to have the latitude to communicate with in either channel and be able to clean it up afterwards was one of the people who I think is a real liability for her at this point, and that is Huma Abedin, who we turns out is now one of those who is adjudicating which of these emails will see public light and which do not.
I think I've read anywhere from 3 to 6 other accounts of associates in the State Department who were doing this. So he had a coterie of friends and intimates that would communicate off the record, so to speak, even on public policy. The problem that she has, I see it as, that it's not just that people remember Filegate or they remember Travelgate or they remember Monica Lewinsky or they remember all those other shenanigans or they remember even her dismal tenure as Secretary of State, but they have a vague sense, though, that they don't really remember Lanny Davis or any of these people, but they have a vague sense that something is happening again and again and again, deja vu. They don't really need the details, but there she is up there, and she basically, in that press conference, she looked tired, she looked inept, old, and more importantly, every single thing she said, I don't think I've ever seen an American political performance in which every statement, I'm not exaggerating, was false. She said she needed 2 devices, not true. She said that a physical Secret Service person on the premises would stop the gift security, false. She said that she turned them in, but she didn't on time. She didn't give the electronic versions, only the printouts. I could go on.
And that everybody's done it. Yeah, this was okay.
Yeah, as other people have done it, they haven't. Nobody has just a dot. Has at least everybody that she mentioned has a .gov account in addition to personal. So she just either is a pathological liar or more disturbing. I think American people have put up with that with her before, but this time she doesn't even seem to know what email is. She doesn't seem to know what cybersecurity is. She seemed confused and angry and sort of, it was basically, I'm Hillary Clinton, you guys, come on.
Yeah, give me a break. Didn't you get the memo?
For the Republicans, it would be good if she was nominated, but I'm not so sure that's a fact these days.
I'm not sure it's going to happen either. Victor Davis Hanson is our guest once again. And just a closing quick question, summary, if you would. You've chronicled, understood, and helped the rest of us think about the fall of great civilizations. Is that what's now in prospect for the United States?
I don't think so. Surely the next administration is going to have to address the debt and what led to the debt and the complexity of the government, the vast size in the government. They're going to have to restore a deterrent and a sane foreign policy. And that's going to cause a lot of people pain, because one thing that we've seen in the last 6 years, there's a lot of people who have come out of the woodwork and are invested in the Obama paradigm. And to reverse that's going to be, if you look at history, it's very hard to scale back entitlements or to recreate a global presence once you've abdicated. Too many people are invested in this new Obama view, and I think we're going to have a lot of social tension in the next, if we get somebody who wants to reform what Obama's done or redress it.
Yeah. Social tension, of course, seems to be something that he's a specialist in generating as a community organizer, I guess. Victor Davis Hanson, thank you for a very bracing and exciting hour conversation. It's always a delight to have a chance to talk with you. Thanks for the great work you're doing at the Hoover Institution, and again, congratulations on The Savior General's marvelous book. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Till then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.